Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 3rd of January. A reminder that Scott Walker will become the new governor of the state of Wisconsin, and we will be covering, well, it's inauguration coverage that begins at noon today here on the Ideas Network and should go from noon until about 1 o'clock or 1:30. And tomorrow, we will, during the 9 o'clock hour of our program today, speak with a Republican. We don't know who the person is yet, but a Republican strategist who believes that this is the right move for the state and also for the country. And we'll look at creation of jobs and how to strengthen the American economy from a Republican perspective tomorrow at 9 o'clock. And at 10 tomorrow, we love to do history shows. You think times are rough now, but look at the revolution. Joseph Ellis has a new book on Abigail and John Adams, who wrote over 1,000 letters to each other. And the book is First Family, so we'll be looking at their extraordinary time in American history and their extraordinary lives tomorrow at 10. This hour of the program, we talk about jobs in this country, and it's not a very happy picture. This is a study, a survey of unemployed American workers that was done by Rutgers University. The finding is the shattered American dream. Unemployed workers are losing faith in their future. Their financial reserves are exhausted. The report says their job prospects nil, their family relations stressed, and their belief in government's ability to help them is negligible. They feel hopeless and powerless, unable to see their way out of the Great Recession that has claimed 8.5 million jobs. We speak this hour with the co-author of this report, Professor Carl Van Horn, professor of public policy and director of the John Heldrich Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University. He has a really interesting background. His research interests are on employment policy, economic development, education policy, state and government, and state government and federalism, and policy analysis and evaluation. He has done quite a bit of work outside the university as well. He has written more than 14 books, including No One Left Behind, Economic Change in the American Worker, and A Nation at Work. He's been director of policy for the state of New Jersey, senior economist at the Joint Economic Committee of the U.S. Congress. He was appointed by President Clinton to a presidential emergency board to mediate a new contract between labor and management in the railroad industry, and the list goes on. We'll be welcoming phone calls, particularly interested in hearing from you who have lost your jobs and either have been able to successfully find a job or find yourself unemployed on this January 3rd of 2011. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, do that at talk@wpr.org. Professor Carl Van Horn, thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning. I'm glad to be with you today.
There are an astounding number of people who are officially classified as jobless.
That's right. I mean, there are, of course, the way we typically report on this from the federal government is you're only unemployed if you're still in the labor force and looking for work and can't find it. But in addition, there are at least a couple of million Americans who are what we call discouraged because they've given up looking. They'd take a job if they could find one, but they've simply given up. And then there's another couple million people who are working in part-time jobs when they really need and want to have a full-time job. So It's a very large number. And overall, in the last few years, of course, it's affected millions and millions of Americans, not just those who are unemployed at this particular moment.
And it affects people in so many ways, right? It affects families. It affects their psychological well-being. Being unemployed is takes in a whole lot of your life.
It does. I'm not a psychologist, but psychologists tell us from their research that it's probably the second most devastating experience that people can have other than losing a spouse or a very close friend or a parent. And so it has many negative consequences, not just the obvious ones, which are financial, But as you said, the emotional stress and the difficulties, the strains it places on an entire family, and then, of course, as it gets larger, it affects an entire community as well.
Tell me about how you took the survey, Professor Van Horn.
Well, at the Heldrick Center for Workforce Development, our goal is to really understand as much as we can about the workforce and the economy. We've been tracking workers for many, many years now. We decided during the recession in 2009 that we were going to interview a set of workers who had lost their jobs during the recession and then continually follow them on a regular basis. So we first interviewed over 1,000 workers, a national random sample of unemployed workers in the summer of 2009. Then we re-interviewed them again in March and in November of 2010. And so we have a unique look at what happens to people when they lose their job in this recession and the extent to which they recover or they don't.
Mm-hmm. And the finding, the number of people who were able after this long period of time to find another job, is not very high.
No, that's an important takeaway lesson from this, that only one in four of the people who lost their jobs were able to get another job, of another full-time job, and another 8% got a part-time job. So that's only a third. The other two-thirds have still languished with unemployment. And those who did get another job usually took a significant pay cut, lost benefits, and so on. So in this recession, given that it's the worst we've had in many, many decades, if you lost your job, the ability to reconnect to the labor force and be successful was very slim. And so these folks are really the victims of a very serious economic decline, one that we haven't seen in a generation or more.
Another takeaway lesson would be that people's retirement plans changed quite significantly.
That's right. It's particularly hard if you lose your job in your 50s. That's probably obvious to most people, but what it means is that you lose the ability at the last few years of your life to build up some savings. Many people who aren't able to get rehired have taken Social Security at an earliest possible point. But, of course, many people aren't yet eligible for that. They're in their 50s. They can't take Social Security. Their 401ks were depleted and probably the value of their house as well. So for these folks, they're facing a retirement future which is significantly less bright than they would have anticipated 5 or 7 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Did you have an idea the kinds of jobs these people had? Were they workers in manufacturing? Were they people who were doing service jobs? What kinds of jobs?
Well, since it's a national random sample, we got workers who are in every kind of occupation, and that's one of the features of this particular recession, other than the healthcare industry, which has been robust in most parts of the country and growing. The rest of the sectors of the economy have been harmed. And other than the Dakotas, which have had pretty good economy during this recession, every other state has also been devastated. So it really was a recession that cut across the board and hurt people in low-end jobs, in manufacturing, in the professional services industry, in finance, and in construction, of course, which was particularly hard hit. So it's unfortunately hit all across the country in just about every sector.
What good things are going on in the Dakotas?
Well, I'm not an expert on the Dakotas, but they have a small population and a stable workforce, and they have the lowest unemployment rate in the country.
We'll have to do a show on that at some point.
You should.
Yeah.
I should go visit, I suppose.
Yeah. The question that you're looking at, I'm sure the bigger question here, too, is whether the U.S. economy is experiencing a temporary downturn or, as we've been talking about for months now, some kind of fundamental and lasting changes that we don't quite have a handle on yet.
Yes, that's an important point. And we asked that question of American workers, and over nearly 6 in 10 said they thought that these are unemployed workers, of course, so they think this is a fundamental change. And it's not, they don't expect the economy to recover anytime soon. Most of them believe that after looking for a year or two, it may take another few years to get another job. And then even if they do, their lives are going to be very different. And they also believe the lives of their children are going to be different, and, of course, their retirement. Now, it's important to point out that although we, in this survey, we just interviewed unemployed workers, they, of course, are in families and in communities that, and their friends who still have jobs, know about these experiences. And so it has a spillover effect, if you will, into families, into communities, because people know, everyone, just about everyone knows a person who has lost a job. In fact, 3 out of 4 Americans in another survey we took told us that either they or someone in their family or a close friend had lost a job during this recession. So it's millions and millions of people.
Yes.
It has a searing effect on a society when you have, just as we did in the Great Depression, a recession that lasts this long and affects this many people.
It must be so hard to be out of work. Well, first of all, the number of people who were not able to find another job, but to be looking for work for as long a period of time as many of those surveyed have been looking, it's a long time.
That's right. This particular recession has the longest period of unemployment on average of any recession since records were kept starting in 1948. But the fact that there many people are in the same boat is cold comfort to the people that are in that boat. They're trying very hard. They're doing everything they can. We hear stories and our respondents tell us about how much effort they put in to no avail. And this is a function of a huge economic collapse which occurred, and it's not their fault, and there's not much they can do about it in most cases. They're just the unfortunate victims of a economic disaster.
Mm-hmm. Do you call for some kind of policy change here as a result of interviewing all of these people, of some way to create jobs for them or a necessity of creating jobs for them?
Well, of course, it's important to do that. I think that the perhaps one of the most important lessons out of this is that the kinds of policies we have in our country to help people in an economic downturn are not really adequate to the task of a recession of this magnitude. So what do I mean by that? Namely, that people who are unemployed for a long period of time need not only unemployment insurance, which is good, but they also are going to need retraining and education to connect to the next job.
Mm-hmm.
And many of our policies are not designed for that purpose. They're really designed to provide short-term training on the assumption that most recessions are short, which is true, but that's not true this time. And we've also known this for many years. There are structural areas of the economy, manufacturing you alluded to before, which have been suffering for a long period of time. But now we see that it's not just manufacturing. There are many other sectors of the economy that also suffer. And so the people who are caught up in this really need a lot of help. And the other point that is perhaps less obvious is that there's the mental health consequences. The psychological impact of a long recession has many, many negative effects on a family and on a community. And we're really not well prepared to deal with that. I mean, the reason is in part because more than half of the unemployed workers do not have health insurance, so they can't even get help that way, and they certainly can't afford it if they don't have insurance. And even those that do have health insurance often don't have mental health services that are adequate. So the whole system is really strained to respond to these crises that people are having, and there are many, I think, silent victims of this process because we don't have an adequate response.
Let's go to some phone calls. Our lines are filled for you. Our number is 800-486-8655. And our guest is Professor Carl Van Horn, Professor of Public Policy and Director of the John Heldrich Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University. They have done an extensive survey of Americans who are officially classified as jobless, at looking at how long people have been unemployed, when they lost their jobs, how many have been able to find work, if so, what are the salaries and the benefits at their new jobs, how many people have given up, and what all of them think about the economy in the United States and the future of the economy as a result of their experience. We start our calls with Sandy from Algoma. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Kathleen. I just wanted to say that I lost my job in 2009. There were 11 of us older workers that were let go from the hospital I worked at. I am a nurse. And it took me almost a year to find another job, which is unheard of for a nurse. I've never been unemployed in my life. And usually they're beating down your door to get you to come and work for them because there still is a somewhat of a nursing shortage. But in any case, over the course of the year, I ended up cleaning out my retirement account just to live on. Mm. They were threatening to foreclose on our house, and we went into the HAMP program, you know, the Make Home Affordable program, which turned out to be a cruel hoax. We jumped through every hoop that they asked us to, and at the end, basically, they said, forget it, we're not helping you, but you can go back into the program again if you want. But in any case, you talk about stress going through this. It was horrible.
And you found something? Were your benefits and your pay similar to what you had before?
Not at all.
No.
I'm making about $1,500 less a month.
Oh.
And I have no health insurance.
You have no health insurance and you're
no
a nurse?
They offered health insurance, but I would have had to pay $800 a month for it. And at that price, I couldn't afford it. So I opted not to take it because otherwise we're going to be not only making $1,500 less, but I'll be making $2,300 less a month. Because my insurance over there that I was making, it was $200 every 2 weeks.
Right.
So, but in any case, it's very stressful.
Yeah. Well, stay with us. Professor Van Horn.
Right. Sandy's story is unfortunately all too common, again, amongst the workers that found full-time work. Only 6 in 10 actually got anything close to the wage and benefits they had before. So most of them, you know, the 40% or more really had to take a reduction. And many workers, of course, who stay in the same field, which Sandy was lucky to do, at least they get a job, but for another large percentage, they have to change careers, and that's an even more difficult hurdle to get the education and training to move into a new field, and then those folks are even more likely to lose income when they get a job.
Mm-hmm. And what about this health insurance? Do you have any place that you can go to get insurance? Because you really need it, Sandy.
I could purchase this, but like I said, we're being squeezed now. I can't imagine that I'm going to be able to find it at a price that I can afford.
That's right. One of the sacrifices that our respondents told us is that they go without needed health care. And obviously without insurance and without the economic means to pay for it, what happens is they show up in the emergency room because that's really the only place they can go. And that means they're not doing preventative health care that they need to do. It also means the cost of their health care service is much higher than it would otherwise be. So, again, this is an example of how unemployment isn't just a problem that attaches to the people that are unemployed. It affects the entire society. It drives up the cost of health care and also makes us a less healthy nation.
Right. So the people, I guess I'm just not sure of what the system is here. People who lose their jobs, and we're talking about millions and millions of Americans, don't have any access to health care benefits?
Well, they do in this sense. They can buy insurance on the private market, as Sandy said. It's very expensive. They can also, if they were with a company that had health insurance, and remember, many Americans don't have it to start with, but if they had it, then they can also buy into a system. It's known as COBRA, which is mm-hmm. complicated acronym, which I won't go into, but it means they can extend their insurance at a somewhat less expensive rate for a while. And there was some support for that from the stimulus package, and that's now going away. That's the federal stimulus package. So those are their options. And then, of course, if they're eventually, and unfortunately, if they reach a point of extreme poverty, then they would be eligible for Medicaid. So there are other. This is an example of the Swiss cheese healthcare system, which will be potentially addressed, but not for several years when
yes.
the Affordable Care Act is eventually implemented.
Mm. Sandy, thanks for the call. We're going to welcome more phone calls in just one moment. Our guest is Professor Carl Van Horn, Professor of Public Policy, Director of the Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University. And we're talking about their report released in December, The Shattered American Dream. Unemployed workers are losing faith in their futures. It's a national survey that looks at the impact of prolonged joblessness. One line is open if you'd like to take it, and you can always send a message if you would prefer. prefer to go that route, that's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, one of our history programs, we love doing this and it puts where we are now in some kind of perspective. Joseph Ellis will be joining us. He's the Pulitzer Prize winning author of Founding Brothers and American Sphinx. He turns his attention in his latest book to Abigail and John Adams, and the book is First Family. Back to phone calls now for Carl Van Horn, let's go to Alan in Madison next. Hi, Alan.
Hi. I have a two-part question. I hope that's okay.
Yeah.
Even when we don't have an abnormally high unemployment rate like we do now, I understand that that for a healthy economy in a capitalistic system, it requires a 3% annual growth rate. Now, I know part of that is because we have an increasing population, but the first part of my question is, what else is, why do we need, other than population, why else do we need rising growth rate every year? And the second part of it is, we live in a finite world with finite natural resources, and continual growth rate is unsustainable. So those are my two-part questions.
Thank you, Alan.
Well, Alan's asked a good question. The growth rate is really essentially determined in terms of unemployment by the size of the workforce, as he suggested. And each month, approximately 125 to 150,000 new workers seek employment, either because of they reach the age where they want to work, or because they've returned to the labor force after perhaps being in the military, or they have been at home raising children, or traveling in other countries, volunteering, doing whatever, they come back into the U.S. labor market. So that, of course, means that we need to grow rapidly enough not only to absorb them, but also, of course, to pick up the people that are still looking for work. And that's why we predict that it will take, we and almost all economists believe it will take several years to recover from this downturn, because there are many people who are on the sidelines that are still wanting to work, and then each month we add new workers.
Thanks very much, Alan, for your call. Patrick in Wauwatosa is our next caller. Hi, Patrick.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm wondering if your guest is familiar with an article that appeared in one of the major newspapers a couple of months back. The basis of the article was that the middle class has essentially become obsolete, and corporate America has kind of written off the middle class, and therefore there's no necessity for them to create jobs. I think perhaps the Christian Science Monitor or one of the major newspapers, and I wish I could remember the article, but it rang pretty true. I thought, sure, what is the incentive for corporate America to do that? They're making record profits without creating jobs. They can send jobs elsewhere or bring people into this country to work for far less compensation. So I'm really wondering if there will be any significant job creation. I think we're waiting for something that's not going to happen. I wonder what your guest thinks about that.
Well, I think eventually it will happen, and the reason is because over time, much of the market for goods and services is not something that can be exported. So it's here, and you can't import all of it either. But the slow growth rate is certainly a function of the fact that in the short run, there's not a need for many companies to do that because there's not a demand. And so they're many ways sitting on the sidelines. As I'm sure Patrick and others have read, there's a lot of capital available for investment, which would, of course, create new jobs. But unless they see a demand or a likelihood that they might lose market share to another company, they're not as inclined to do that. But eventually, growth not only in this economy but around the world is something that will create jobs for people. It just takes a long time to occur. The idea that the middle class is going away or is obsolete, I guess, is to me, that's really a bit more rhetoric and some hyperbole that many people indulge in. I think what's probably more accurate is that many people in the economy are suffering from the lack of wage increases, which is occurring in the middle and lower wage tiers, and that's been going on for some period of time. That's a function primarily of the restructuring of the economy, so that many of the jobs that heretofore paid middle-class wages have been outsourced, manufacturing jobs. And now in this recession, we add to that the construction industry, which has been devastated. Both of those industries tended to pay way above the lower wage rungs. And so they were semi or highly skilled workers who earned good incomes. And many of those jobs have been hurt in this recession.
I'm remembering another article, too. I remember a lot of articles. But it was the article, and it received some attention, that looked at, let's continue on this, record profits, fourth quarter profits for many corporations in this country. And if they're making record profits, somebody's buying their products, right? And I don't understand this, all this money being, where is all this money that could create new jobs or better wages for people who work for those companies? Where's the money?
Well, remember that these are companies that are able to borrow money at very historically low rates, right? So the Federal Reserve is making, and other banks are making money available at a very low rate. So they're stockpiling capital in the way that any of us would if we had the means to do that. And as I said before, in the absence of pressure to, that is, of market pressure to create jobs, they're going to not do that. Instead, they can find more productive ways, which really means doing the same work with less people, and earn high profits, and the shareholders will reward them. And that's exactly what has happened in publicly traded companies. As I think most of your listeners will know, the stock market has gone up in the last 2 years. This last year, the net increase was in the normal indexes was over 10%. So there's no pressure on the part of the shareholders or institutional investors for them to behave differently.
Well, something's kind of wrong with all of that, isn't it?
Well, again, it depends on what position you are in the economy. It's certainly wrong from a, if you want to put that label on it, in terms of the job creation strategy.
Yes.
But that is the capitalist system that we live in, and it doesn't respond quickly to recessions. In fact, as we know, the employment is usually the last indicator to improve in recessions historically. If we go back to the Great Recession, the Great Depression, the labor market really was devastated for a decade and a half, and it really came out after it came back really after, during, and after World War II. So the recession started in the 30s and really recovered in the late 40s. I don't think we're looking at something of that magnitude this time, but I think the consensus is that most of the rest of this decade will have high unemployment rates, even with good growth. So, because, again, remember back to what we talked about before, if you have rapid growth in the economy, which would be, let's say, 4 or 5%, that goes back to a growth rate we had in the late 90s, which was a boom period. We'd have to have that for a few years to reduce this deep bench of unemployed workers so that we could get down to a 4% or less unemployment rate.
So are we looking at a 10% unemployment rate for the rest of this decade?
No, I don't think so. I think when I say high, I mean 7, 8% perhaps. Most of the consensus forecast is for the next few years it'll probably be at that level. And that's not one that I find acceptable, or I don't think the American people will find acceptable. But I think it's that it's to remain that way forever but I think it will remain high for several years at least.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to an email. Somebody who wants to be anonymous. I've been unemployed for a year now. Thankfully, our family has been able to scrape by with the support of some family and friends. I'm sad and surprised to say that other friends and family have been less than helpful or supportive, and they're the ones who are the most financially well off. I wonder if it's because they work for some of the big companies that got the country in this situation and have a character that is only motivated by personal greed. Some of them continue to ask me for help with their own projects while ignoring even small requests for help like company contracts, et cetera. Not a good feeling and very hard to stay motivated.
That's an interesting point that we found that almost half of the workers that we interviewed said that they had borrowed money from family and friends. So at least half of them were successful in getting help from other folks. And there is a lot of generosity, I think, in this period of time that we find from the employed workers. That doesn't mean everybody is that way. We asked a sample of people who were still employed what they thought about unemployed workers, a number of questions. And essentially, the bottom line from that is there's great sympathy and empathy with the problem, and in many ways, a feeling of generosity, both with their own resources and with government spending. So, for example, I'm sure some of your listeners have heard the criticism of unemployed workers that somehow they're not trying hard enough, that they're slackers.
Right.
The prevailing view of the American public is quite the opposite. They actually believe that most unemployed workers are there through no fault of their own and that we should help them through government unemployment insurance and other programs, as well as charitable giving. So the American people are more generous, I think, than some politicians.
Hmm. Let's go next to Dwight from Wausau. Hi, Dwight.
Hi, good morning. You had mentioned earlier about North Dakota having a very low unemployment rate, and one of the reasons for that is that North Dakota has a huge oil field that's being developed out there right now. And because of the fact that they have a fairly sparse population, a lot of people are coming in. Everybody that wants a job that can work probably can get a job there. But that said, because this current administration has done everything they could to so far to stymie any domestic oil production, we're in a situation right now, if there's any interruption in world supply, we're going to be in deep, deep trouble. They're talking about $4 a gallon gasoline by May and maybe $5 by December. And if we have a supply interruption, I'm afraid that this country will not only have double-digit unemployment, we'll probably be in the 20s and 30s because I don't see any way that we can produce the oil that we're going to need to keep this economy going. As a matter of fact, if you go a little bit farther down the road, we could be looking at food riots and complete disruption in the cities because people won't be able to afford anything. And then you throw quantitative easing in there that the government has done, and the inflation that's coming down the road will be horrendous. If we start bailing out states with money that we don't have to do so, we could lose the reserve currency status, and our dollar would be worth practically anything. So we're in deep doo-doo, whether anybody wants to admit it or not.
Professor. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Dwayne. Thanks for the call. Or Dwight. Thanks for the call, Dwight.
Well, that's an even more bleak picture than I would paint. But again, there are many things that could send our economy into a further tailspin. The caller mentioned a couple. I think that, however, my view on the last 3 or 4 years is that we were on the brink of a much more serious problem, and between the actions of the Congress and both the Bush and the Obama administration, we were able to avoid that and the Federal Reserve Bank. So hopefully, that will continue. I think the stimulus package that was, which is not called stimulus, but it was a stimulus package in the agreement reached in December, was one that continues to provide the kind of propping up of demand that is necessary to keep the economy moving ahead and keep us from falling back into a second recession. So I'm a bit more optimistic, although, again, there are always things on the horizon, terrorist attack, God forbid, a oil interruption, other problems that could return us to an even more serious problem than we have right now.
Don in Madison, hi.
Oh, good morning.
Hi, Don.
As the previous caller said, things are pointing in the direction of popular unrest, resentment, exemplified, I think, by the Tea Party, and civil disruptions that might ensue, you know, after years of this sort of suffering, were in the 30s mollified by unions who mollified and regulated the tendency of people to go out on wildcat strikes and just cause uproar. Unions might be a good way to help solve some of our trouble. That's the extent of my comment.
Okay, thank you, Don. Professor Van Horn.
Yeah, a couple of points that raised are interesting, your caller. The first is that you would think that in this particular economy it would give a boost to unionization. That hasn't happened yet, but it may yet, because in this current circumstances, employers have enormous leverage, and the way in which workers can protect themselves is to organize and to have a collective voice. So we'll see. I mean, that may occur in the next few years. It may not. Certainly, public employee unions are under attack right now, and to cut their benefits and cut their wages. And of course, it may layoffs have been planned for them, I think, in the next few years. The other point that he raised about social unrest, an interesting observation about if you look around the world in other developed countries, the kinds of unrest that we're seeing in Europe is in Greece and in Britain, France, much greater than we see in this country. And that has been the pattern, really, for many decades, that American society is much more stable, less prone to that. And we'll see, again, as long as this crisis continues, if the kinds of various services and other strategies we have to help people in times of need are diminished, for example, if we got rid of unemployment insurance or we cut food stamp programs and things like that, you might find a bit more of that. But thus far, the reaction has been quiet suffering rather than social public unrest and civil disobedience. Again, I have no prediction on that, but it's just an observation that so far this country has not seen the same reaction as we find in some of other developed countries that have serious economic problems.
More phone calls momentarily. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Professor Carl Van Horn, director of the Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University, is our guest, and we're looking at this long-term survey that was done of unemployed workers, and it's not a pretty picture. This shows that more than 15 million Americans are officially classified as jobless, and our guest followed a representative sample of workers from the summer of 2009, reported their latest survey came out in December. The Shattered American Dream: Unemployed Workers Lose Ground, Hope, and Faith in Their Futures. Over 15 months of surveys, one quarter of workers only have found full-time jobs, nearly all of them for less pay with fewer or no benefits. The recession has been a cataclysm that will have an enduring effect. It is hard to overstate the dire shape of the unemployed. Nearly two-thirds of unemployed workers surveyed have been out of work for a year or more. More than a third have been jobless for 2 years. And, of course, that can lead to your savings being exhausted, and perhaps your relatives who've been asked for help have reached their limit as well. More phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Oh, the email address, did I give it to you? talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during our 9 o'clock hour, what are the Republican plans for creating jobs in this state and in the country? And at 10 o'clock, Joseph Ellis will be joining us, author of a number of award-winning books. His latest is First Family, Abigail and John Adams. Back to phone calls now as we look at unemployment. Professor Carl Van Horn, professor of public policy, director of the Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University, is our guest. And Frank from Madison is our next caller. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Frank.
Happy New Year
Happy
to you
New
and
Year.
Your guest.
Happy New Year to you, Frank.
I would like to, this is a bit nerdy, but there's a interesting point that was made by the OECD, which is sort of the rich nations club technical backup team in Europe, that given the expected and actual underperformance of the American economy, that they stated explicitly, these are not policy people, that a substantial improvement of the social safety net was required to prevent setting in permanent underperformance of the American economy. And what's interesting is that we actually are at depression levels of underemployment. It's about 17%, which is where the U.S. was in the middle of the depression. So why are we not doing that, and why is there this resistance to the spending that would create demand, which is what would make industry, business, employ people and get us out of what is a trap? So thank you very much.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, thank you, Frank. As a professor, I always like nerdy questions. and Happy New Year to you, too.
Frank has good questions always.
Let me unpack a little bit. In terms of the what is happening to the safety net, that's typically different than when it comes to what would create demand. So the safety net is helping people survive. And we have had, for our country, relatively continuing support for unemployment insurance longer than we've ever had before, although, again, it was close to being eliminated, which would have been, I think, quite devastating, not only to those people, but it would also have hurt the economy in general. And we also have other services, but it's a leaky safety net. As we've talked about before, we don't have substantial health insurance for many people, and many of the services are not available to folks because there's just too much demand for them and not enough money. In terms of creating demand, that is what the government has been doing and the Federal Reserve Bank in the best way they could over the last several years now. The agreement that was just reached in December continues along that path. Much of it is demand. Now, there, of course, there are those who would say that it's not enough and those who say it's too much. But in a democracy, what happens is you find that the medium that can get sufficient votes in the House and Senate. And that's, of course, what happened. The reaction, of course, in the last election was predominantly one that supported a policy that seemed to be more oriented towards slower spending. But when we asked people what they thought about the election, the median or the modal response, I should say, was they didn't think either party, Democrats or Republicans, or the president or the Republicans in the Congress were going to be much help to them. And they don't have a great deal of trust in the political system to support them. So the issue here really is there isn't, I don't think, from the work that we've done, any evidence of a mandate for anyone. Going forward, what we have to find is a policy that actually helps the economy, which I think is the way people will judge it. I don't think that there's going to be a lot of support for the rhetoric of budget cutting, even though people would like that to happen, and who wouldn't like that to happen, to cut taxes. Everybody supports that at some level. But if that's injurious to the economy, the American people would judge that quite negatively. So, again, those who think that there was a huge mandate out of this election, I think are mistaken. I think it's actually the only mandate is do something to fix the problem. People are very frustrated, of course, but the direction of their frustration is not clear as to what the policy response should be.
Do you have any suggestions?
Well, I'm not a politician, but I do believe that we do have to strengthen the safety net for the reasons I've mentioned before, not only because we can't really afford to economically, and we certainly shouldn't socially, just cast aside all the folks who've been suffering in this recession. We need to have them back in the workforce. We need to help them reconnect, both because for their own sake and also for the rest of the society. And so that really means cutting spending would not be the right thing to do of those programs that support the unemployed and help them get education and training to get a better job.
Yeah. Here's an email that's come in. I have been out of work for just over 3 years. I was a middle manager for a bank for 17 years and find that not only the economy, but age and attitude are also against me. He discovered a Wisconsin program. I'm not familiar with this, but we'll try to find it, that will pay for my returning to school and doing a complete career change after 40 years. I expect that on completion of this two-year program, I will be earning, should I find employment, at approximately one-third of my previous annual earnings.
Well, that's sad to hear, but it's good that he has access to a job or to a training program that will allow him to do that. Many people don't, as I said before, and they, insofar as they do training, they invest their own money, which they're probably already depleted, but that's the best they can do. I would say when it comes to education and retraining that although in general it's a good thing, it's important for anyone embarking on that journey to be very careful about that because you don't want to go through an education and training program and wind up on the other end still seeking work and
that's for
not
sure.
being successful. And the only way that you can protect against that is to investigate very carefully the education and training program that you're thinking of enrolling in. Ask them to show you evidence of people getting jobs and the kind of money they earned. All that is available, and much of it is available from probably the Wisconsin Department of Labor or other independent sources other than the education and training institution.
Thank you, Frank, for your nerdy good question. Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi.
Hi. Thanks very much. Well, I'm kind of on the same page as a caller a little while ago about unions because, well, you're saying that there's going to have to be some sort of market pressure to get employers to hire more. And it just seems to me, well, my understanding of capitalism is that employers will always look for the highest profits. And if they've discovered they can get some more out of workers, they're just going to keep doing that. And, well, historically, ever since the beginning of the industrial age, that's what employers did, and it was only labor. It was only organized labor that managed to change working conditions and prevent exploitation. So I'm just wondering, if really, how there could be any other way to improve that situation now.
Well, I agree with much of what you said. I think that if you go back 100 years. We had a six-day week or seven-day week, and we had no child labor laws and so on and so forth. And except for the social and union movements to change that, we might still have that. So I agree, Bennett. Unions in the private sector have been declining in terms of their representation in the workforce, and the unions have been struggling to organize other parts of the economy. It's possible that out of this recession you will see a resurgence of that. It's too early to tell. But certainly right now, most people are in a situation where they're at what we call at-will employees, so they can be fired for any reason whatsoever. So they have no representation in that process. And they also can have their wages pressed down because they have no contract. So again, whether that happens or not, time will tell, but it would be an important counterpoint to the right now the power that employers have. If we go back just over a little over 10 years ago, employers were paying bonuses, raising wages, and so on. Why? Because there was a labor shortage. Right now, there's a labor surplus. There's probably five or six qualified applicants for every job opening, and maybe dozens more unqualified applicants. So it's very easy for employers to pick and choose, and it's also easy for them in their own minds to dismiss workers because they figure rightfully there's probably another person eligible to do that. I should add, however, that it's difficult to generalize about employers and not overgeneralize. You can easily overgeneralize because there's so many thousands of employers that actually treat their workers very well. But the prevailing pattern right now, of course, is not to raise wages and to be have the opportunity to do what they want with their workforce in a way that is not to the benefit of workers.
We should ask where people can find this study. I would imagine that it's online right now, isn't it?
It is. Our website is www.heldrich, that's H-E-L-D-R-I-C-H, .rutgers.edu, and of course it's free to anyone who would like to download it from our website, and there are many other studies on that website as well, including the reports from the other surveys that we did in the last year and a half. Mm.
And will you continue to follow these people?
Yes, we will. We think it's important to document what happens to workers in this recession, and we hope that it helps influence not only public understanding, but also public policy to understand how difficult it is and what unemployed workers need in order to be successful again.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. It was my pleasure.
Our guest this hour, Professor Carl Van Horn, and he is director of the Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University. Christy's going to put the study on our Facebook page, too. So if you go to the Kathleen Dunn Show, you can get much more information about what these people think about who's going to help them. And it's not the Democrats and it's not the Republicans. So who is it? And we'll give you a lot more about this very extensive survey. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this program and to Chrissy as well for on-air production. We're with you again tomorrow and hope you'll listen.